Okay, guys, what a pleasure it is to have the great activist, the lovely, the charming, the fun, the intelligent Faisal Saeed Al-Muhtar. But here's the problem. I heard that well, first say hello, Faisal, before I
Hi, John. How are you?
good. God, not Jad, God.
Oh, God.
Yes. So I heard that there is a potential that you could be a Jasus Yahudi, a Jewish spy. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sing a song from my childhood in Arabic. I know that a lot of the folks who listen to this really get a kick when they hear me speaking in Arabic. And so interrupt me at any point if you know who the singer is. This will prove to us that you're definitely not a Zionist shill. Are you ready?
Okay, that's a tough one.
All right, here we go. بكتب اسمك يا حبيبي على حور العتيق بتكتب اسمي يا حبيبي على الرمل الطريق بكرة بتشتي الدنيا على القصص المجرحة بيبقى اسمك يا حبيبي واسمي بينمحى بيبقى اسمك يا حبيبي واسمي بينمحى. What do you got for me?
I mean, the song is very familiar, right?
Uh-oh.
Not Fairuz, right? No.
You have just cleared the benchmark. You are safe. It
Oh,
is Fairuz.
cool. Okay.
Very good.
Yeah.
Great job.
Yeah, because we used to listen to it every day on the buses back in Iraq. I mean, that's probably the only singer I can recognize easily.
Yeah, well, Fairuz was very much a huge star in my time when I was growing up in Lebanon, which of course leads us next to maybe you could start us off. I know you've discussed this in other venues, but some of the viewers here may not know about your very interesting personal history. Can you tell us a bit about it? What?
Yeah,
How? Go ahead.
sure. I mean, I was, as I mentioned, I mean, I was born and raised in Iraq. I was born in the city of Babylon, that probably many people are familiar with. But my family moved up to Baghdad since I was a very young age. So I grew up mostly in Baghdad, and then, so I grew up under the sanctions. So I was born in 1991. I grew up under the sanctions, and then. Obviously, it was Saddam Hussein, and then we moved up. The war happened, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and yeah, and then after didn't really take long time, and until the Al Qaeda and all the militant forces got getting mobilized, and I started seeing the civil war in front of my eyes, in which I see Al Qaeda controlling many parts of the neighborhood. They used to like come to my high school and take students and kidnap them, and they used to close streets by dead bodies. And in 2007, it started hitting home after my eldest brother was kidnapped by Al Qaeda and disappeared afterwards. And same goes with my cousin. And I started getting vocal pretty much since the Iraqi elections in 2005, in which I saw the sectarian parties rising up in Iraq and obviously getting elected eventually. So I started a big advocate for secularism and things of that sort. So I also started becoming a target, and I started getting death threats and stuff. So fast forward, I mean, after what happened to my brother and my cousin, I left after I finished high school to Lebanon, actually.
Right.
And I was applying to visa for the UK, because I have relatives there, and I was rejected three times, saying that I don't have enough money, and they always wanted to make a mistake in the application, so they wouldn't want me to be there. So after that, I left Lebanon and I went to Malaysia, and I did studies there. And within that time, I was waiting for my refugee case to be approved. And at the same time, I started what is now probably the most popular Facebook page, the Global Secular Humanist Movement.
Yes.
And I
Over
was like,
300,000, right?
yeah, about 300,000 and like
Incredible.
a reach of like 4 or 5 million.
Wow.
And so, yeah, and I came into the United States in about March 2013. So it's been about 2 years and a half. And I've been on the road since then. Between giving speeches, and then in June 2014, I got a job at an organization started by Google and now acquired by organization called Fast Human Rights. It's called movements.org. So what we do, movements.org, is what people like me used needed back in Iraq, like receiving help in media, in legal help, in web design, and things of that. So yeah, some part of my story has inspired me to go and try to help the folks over there who are in countries like Iraq and many parts of the Arab world. And I do speeches and writing on the side, talking about issues related to Islam and Islamism. And
yes, we'll get into all that.
I'm sure we're going to touch on
we'll
that.
Touch everything.
And so that's probably a summary.
That's great. That's very good. So is most of your family still in Iraq?
No, they all left.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say that clearly there might be
well,
security
I mean, they,
issues.
They left right? very recently. Before they arrived, I mean, the ISIS was like not more than 20 miles away from.
Right.
So, like, there were months that I couldn't even sleep. And considering that, I mean, both of my parents are old, like, it really doesn't take ISIS to kill them. I mean, somebody with a stick can beat the shit out of both of them and get them dead. So, thankfully, now most of them, I mean, all of them moved to the West. I mean, I still have, obviously, relatives living in Iraq, but not immediate family.
Right, right. So it took you 4 years in terms of your journey to eventually land in the United States, correct? Is that roughly the timeline?
Yeah. I mean, from 2009 to 2013, yeah, it's about 4 years. And I mean, that's generally like the story of many people. Many people expect that like refugees or like people who look for asylum move immediately from the east to the west. But generally, like most people go to middle countries like Turkey or back at the time, back in my time, it used to be Syria.
Right.
Syria was the place in which Iraqis used to go to apply for refugee status. And now Syrians are coming to Iraq for safety. So that says a lot about the situation over there.
Right.
And yeah, so it's about 4 years.
Right. So, I mean, I guess your journey is relevant to a contemporary issue that we're facing in Canada, or certainly the West is facing. And that is sort of the flux of the influx of refugees that are applying to come to Western countries. So in Canada, for example, our new prime minister has promised to let in 25,000 Syrian refugees. And actually, if last week when I had our mutual friend Ali Rizvi on the show, we talked about this issue and that somewhere there is a happy medium between, you know, the folks who say, you know, shut the door to everybody, and the folks who have a very lax open door policy, and if you question anything, then you must be some racist bigot. So, what's your position on? I mean, surely you can appreciate the concern that not that every single one of the or many would be ISIS guys, but even the fact that many of them might hold values that are inconsistent with the liberal values that you and I fight for, is that a concern, or how do you navigate through this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's raising a concern about the beliefs of the people who are coming to the United States, I think is a very legitimate one. And I think that this, I mean, in my case, I mean, I did a lot of interviews before I was able to come to the United States. I mean, it was not just they let me in. I had to do a lot of interviews. I had to tell my story so many times. I had to prove that I'm in danger in the country that I escaped. Do I think that the vetting system could be improved? I definitely think so. I think that the United States, I mean, I don't know about Canada, but I think the United States can utilize people who are former refugees or people or Iraqi war veterans who have experience in Iraq and who can at least get a better understanding of the refugees than a high school graduate from Arkansas. I think that if we can utilize folks like this, that will improve the vetting system. But I'm definitely, I mean, as a refugee, I can definitely say I'm pro people escaping for their life. I mean, I'm one of them. So,
well, so am I.
So it's, I think, I mean, it's a very tough subject. And I'm obviously against these people who say that the United States should be an open door. I mean, and at the same time, they don't want to improve the Homeland Security, and they always complain about civil liberties. I mean, you cannot maintain these two things if you're going to let everybody in.
Right.
I think that the solution, I mean, many people are always, obviously, their mind is on the refugees, but we also have to ask is that why these refugees exist? And these refugees exist is because of continuous failure in politics in Syria. And many people would not be refugees if the situation was good over there. And the way I see it is that there are two options with the continuous conflict. I think most of the Syrians will be refugees.
Right.
So we're literally talking about 15 to 20 million people.
Right.
And I think that the best way is to actually focus more on trying to figure out a solution to both of these countries. I mean, obviously, the refugees are all the Syrians. There are a lot of refugees come from Afghanistan, Eritrea, and sub-Saharan Africa. So they're all mixed up together with the war Syrian refugees. I mean, if you look at when I came to the United States, like my plane was filled with people from Myanmar and people from Cambodia. And so like the refugees is a continuous thing.
Sure.
But when it comes to these specific countries, Syria and Iraq, I mean, there has been a lot of failures, I think, from the West and mostly from Europe, which has always tried to not engage in the Middle East in the name of in the name of anti-war and things of that sort. Eventually, it kind of backfired because if you're not interested in the Middle East is interested in you.
Right.
So you cannot just leave the Middle East handle its issues by itself. It never happens. Its location, it's very close to Europe. It has many, like a lot of people can navigate to other countries. Like the Middle East cannot be contained if there's no solution in that place.
Do you think that there needs to be increased pressure on some of the neighboring countries that have taken supposedly zero refugees to try to do their share, somewhere between zero and a million, say that what Germany has taken in is a happy medium in terms of what, for example, the Gulf states should do. Does it not strike you as quite extraordinary that the West is asked? Now, of course, in the West, we're compassionate. We want to help anybody that deserves to be helped. And so, of course, as humanitarians, we should do that. But it also is quite extraordinary that they get a complete free pass, right? So Sweden has to take in so many people that, I mean, pretty much their economy now is collapsing because of the amount of economic stress it's putting on them, never mind sort of incongruencies between the value systems of the host nation and the refugees coming in. So what do we do to get some of those neighboring countries that share their religion, that share many of the values, to do more? Is there anything we can do, or it's a lost battle?
Well, I mean, neighboring countries, I mean, Lebanon and Turkey are taking actually most of the refugees. I mean, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan are taking the most. But obviously, I mean, when it comes to the Gulf states, I mean, they are part of the problem to begin with. I mean, they have played a role in sponsoring many of the militias that some of them have joined ISIS, or if they have not funded ISIS themselves. And the ideology of ISIS and the ideology of Saudi Arabia are not really that distant.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that, I mean, part of the... not. Because it's very important to talk about foreign policy, but is that part of the war on terror, I think, is that the West should maintain a higher moral stance because we cannot win this war if we're not going to stand by the values we support. And one of the values that the West support is to help those in need. And that, I think, what makes the West beats the rest. I mean, is that... that we are in a war of ideas, and in order for us to maintain this war of ideas, we have to maintain the moral superiority to Saudi Arabia. I mean,
yes.
I don't want to compete my morality to Saudi Arabia.
Sure,
like I don't want the United States to be morally equivalent. No, I don't want Canada to be morally equivalent to Saudi Arabia. So I'm not going to compete who's worse. But I can definitely say that if there is any pressure to be put, I mean, at least let them stop supporting terrorists in Syria and Iraq. I mean, I think we can all agree on that. Is that at least for a start, let them not accept any refugees, but at least let them not be part of the problem.
Right.
Because they are part of the problem.
Hold on. Sarcasm warning. We've yet to talk about the real culprit in this whole crisis, one that I had to deal yesterday a whole day with it, with the Ostrich Brigade, and that's, of course, climate change, since, of course, we all know that the real culprit in the Middle East is, I mean, you really can't believe, Faisal, the number of people I had to tackle yesterday who were profoundly angry at me that I wasn't willing to concede that that climate change issues, drought and urbanization and lack of whatever resources and agricultural crop prices going down, those were all important factors. So maybe we could talk about this next, because it kind of taps into something that you've discussed, I've discussed, Dave Rubin's discussed, the regressive left, I like to call them the Ostrich Brigade.
The labels are increasing. We at least give one label.
I needed to mark my own territory. I can't jump on the regressive left bandwagon. It's all marketing, baby. How can you get through to somebody who is able to argue with you all day that climate change is actually an important, now they will concede that it's not the only factor, but it's a very important factor. How do we deal with such idiocy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm very certain that most of the people who claim that the climate change is one of the main problems do not think that there is a main problem that I think both of us agree on, which is the main problem. So they always try to find a secondary or third things that they can lump it. I wouldn't deny that economy has the Arab Spring started with the problems, sure, with dictatorships concentrated a huge amount of money and their small families and all of that. So obviously the economic, that's how the Arab Spring started and eventually led its way to Syria. And as when it comes to climate change, yes, that doesn't mean that it cannot be contained. I mean, if there was no Bashar al-Assad, he probably have dealt with economics than others. So I think that the people, it's not about the people you talk to, is that Bernie Sanders, actually, the presidential candidate to the United States that has a lot of popularity, has said that climate change is also one of the main issues. I mean, as far as I remember, I think the New York Times reported on it too. I think that whenever, if somebody wants to find secondary or third, they'll always try to find them and always try to talk about them as the main ones, and then say, if you disagree with that, then you're a racist.
So let's talk about the primary one, which of course we both know is the New Atheist Liberation Front. So maybe we could start by talking, in all seriousness, let's talk about Islam. I don't know where you want to start. Do you want to start right away by talking about some of the important reformers that are trying to reform Islam? Actually, before we do that, before we do that, I think what's important to sort of admit is that there are sort of different camps. There's, at least certainly in my experience with engaging with a lot of these folks, some will claim there is absolutely nothing to reform, right? So those are, if you'd like, the most impenetrable ones, right? Because they say, look, it's a perfect system. Islam is beautiful. It's perfect. It's the final inerrant word of God, blah, blah, blah. Then you've got those who wish to reform Islam, but then I call them, these are all, I think, my terms, I call them subscribers to unicorn Islam. And the unicorn manifests itself in different ways. So you could be a unicorn. So if you are a gay Muslim reformer, you suddenly create a narrative that says, no, but in true Islam, there's actually great plurality when it comes to sexual orientation. Then you've got a Muslim who is a reformer, but who loves Jews because he knows Mordechai Silverstein, who's a good friend of his, says, no, absolutely, no anti-Semitism in the Quran and the Hadith and the Seerah, nothing. Nothing happened. You misunderstood, you misinterpreted. So, and then you've got, of course, other guys who are reformers, but then the way that they want to go about the reform, I may disagree with. So what do you think about these different camps, and are they all equally penetrable, or should we just give up on some of them because we can never reach them?
Well, I mean, the Arab history, I mean, let's go back a bit, some history. I mean, there was a group of people started, I think, within the Abbasiyya, Hukm al-Abbasi, Abbasid regime. They were called al-Mu'tazila. I don't know if
Yes.
you're familiar with them.
Yes, of course.
Al-Mu'tazila said that, I mean, as far as I remember, is that they said that the Quran has some like it's not the complete word of the creator of the universe, and it should be open to interpretation, and we should not take it fully literally. And there's a movement called an ijtihad, in which the interpretation comes from. So the history of reform has been going on kind of for a very long time within the Muslim world. That, as probably most of the liberals don't think, is that it existed long before America and Israelis have even existed.
Yeah.
So it has long history. But what happened is that the political Islamic movement was able to crush the reform, the crush the reformers, and so they won. So the Islamists, the political Islamists, won over the reformers back about 1,000 years ago. And since
Sorry,
then,
before you go on, let me interject. There's a great book. I think it's called The Closing of the Muslim Mind that actually goes over this exact schism that happened about a thousand years ago and how the guys who were literalists won that important debate. So for the ones who are watching, they might want to check out that book.
And what the literalists have is that the literalists have violence on their side, and they obviously able to succeed on that regard. And afterwards, when the Ottoman Empire came in, and since then, so the Ottoman Empire, and there was the Persian Empire on the east, the Safawiyyin, and there was a continuous conflict between them, the Sunnis and the Shias, and that kept the Arab world and the Muslim world in a complete like sleep mode. Until World War I, the Ottoman Empire fell down, in which there was two movements coming up, which is the pan-Arab nationalism and the Islamism movement, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood. And so there is a history, it comes to the reform movement, that happened before I think the names we're going to mention. So the I mean, when it comes to the people who like to refer to as unicorn Islam or things of that sort, is that, do I think that Islam is capable of reform?
Yes.
I mean, ISIS is a reformation of Islam. Let's not forget that Wahhabism and Salafism and all the ultra-Orthodox people are also considered themselves reformers. So Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, the leader of the Wahhabi movement, was considered a reformer. So what we're talking about is modernization, not necessarily reform, but the modernization in the religion. I think that it is possible, but I think it's also very hard. Is that within I mean, because many people say that, oh, if Christianity has its reformation, if Judaism has its reformation, why is that to Islam? I mean, that is the hypothesis. It's not a theory. So it's still, for these two religions, Judaism, I mean, for Judaism, there is the logistics, which is that Jews are very small in numbers, that if they apply the whole commandments of themselves, they're going to be all dead today. And I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of the commandments in Deuteronomy and stoning women to death for adultery. If they apply that today, all the Jewish women probably won't be dead by now. So there's a logistical point of view within Judaism that makes it forced to reform, or also there's no concept of strong concept of afterlife. So within Christianity, is that there were a lot of loopholes that the people within the Enlightenment movement, or like, I forget the main verse, but it's because like, do what the Caesars like.
Give unto Caesar's what's his and give to God's.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's this loophole that somebody can definitely utilize.
I think it's
Say,
Matthew, it's from Matthew, maybe.
yeah, is that this is about separation of church and state? Is that the government has its role, and the people should have the rule? So there are these loopholes that make Christianity much more susceptible to reform. Obviously, we think of that as common sense. Back at the time, they were arguing about 24/7, but that is not the case within Islam, because Islam I mean, it is a mother religion by compared to both of them. And also, the Quran was written within a very short, like either when Muhammad was Prophet Muhammad was living or afterwards. So it didn't really take long time, like just the case for Christianity, in which you can see the contradiction is very obvious with Matthew and John, Luke, and because the New Testament was written 300 years afterwards.
Right.
So the Quran makes it much more easier to be taken literally than other religions. And to go through the reform, or the modernization, sorry, like what people like Majid Nawaz or Asra Nomani, and both of them are very close and dear friends of mine. So, yes. Like, I have huge respect for them. Is a hugely difficult subject. Like, to go from the Quran into I support gay rights is extremely, like, difficult process. And what I'm seeing right now, because, I mean, my work is, I work from 9 to 9, actually, is that most of my work is focused on research, on finding solutions about the Arab world and the Muslim world. So, like, and what I have seen is that there are more atheists in the Arab world than there are Muslim reformers, which is, but may sound counterintuitive, because whenever I talk about the subject, many people say, like, it seems like much easier to reform Islam and make more Muslims believe in modernity and liberalism than to make them apostates.
So you'd want to skip the whole Reformation exercise?
No, I don't think I want to skip, but I think that the apostatization mode is very ignored. Is that many people will say, like, oh, it looks very difficult that, like, we can convert 1.5 billion Muslims to atheism, but I think it's much more difficult to create a modern. Not that I say it's impossible. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of Muslims who do believe in a very modern version of Islam. But I think atheism sounds much, much, it's much less work.
Right.
And it is, and I think that there is a lot of sense within a human being for truth. And to go, like, the reform movement, like, it makes somebody look very confused, in my opinion. Like, and I make a lot of conversation with them. Is that, for example, the book of Majid Nawaz and Sam Harris, in which he said that the book, like the Quran, is like the book of Shakespeare. There are good parts and there are bad parts. That sounds good in theory, but the first ayah in Surah Al-Baqarah, it says, like, this هذا الكتاب لا ريب فيه, is that this book is infallible.
Uh-huh.
So if the first verse of Surah Al-Baqarah that says this book is infallible, it's very hard for a reader to go for a conclusion that this is like the book of Shakespeare.
Right.
Because, second of all, Shakespeare did not claim to be a prophet from God.
Right.
he was a playwright. And people don't look at this, the books of Shakespeare, as any sense holy. Maybe they will find them wonderful or majestic, but they will never find them holy, that they would live their lives by the commandments of this book. So I think that the best, like, I think that obviously I'm not going to discount reform, but I think we have to go both sides equally. Like the atheists trying to counter the main narrative of the Islamic religion itself, and the reform who try to change things from within.
Here's the problem. From the sort of most notorious current reformers, when I hear them offering tools by which reformation could happen, I could very, very easily see how, from a doctrinal perspective, what they're saying is absolutely false. So I'll just take an example.
Just one second. Do you include Ayaan Hirsi Ali? Because Ayaan Hirsi Ali is also wrote a book about reformation. Is she within
that? Well, I mean, in her case, she actually, by her doing the dichotomy of Meccan versus Medinan, it's going to speak to my point, right? So if you take somebody who says, well, you know, if you take this particular verse, that's a very nice one, that's the one we have to use rather than the ugly one. But we also know that there is a concept of abrogation, right? Where the later verse, right? I mean, I know you know, I'm saying it for the viewers, right? So
yeah.
So then we know that the later verse, which is a more violent one, the Medinan one, will abrogate, it will nullify the earlier one. So to simply state that, well, you know, we just have to focus on this cute one, either suggests that that person is not aware of the doctrinal tools that are available to you, or is engaging in willful deception. I mean, I'm not sure. So that's what frustrates me with some of the reform attempts. I am very, very strongly in favor of having a discussion about reform, but the Reformation has to be rooted in doctrinal realities, because otherwise it's going to fail. And the reality is you can't sit and have a discussion of every single harf, right? Every single, letter.
Yeah.
Because we're rearranging the decks on the sinking Titanic, right? There sort of has to be a new revelation that comes out that says, all right, we changed our mind. Now it's the earlier Meccan verses that are the key ones. And that's it. That abrogates the abrogation and we're good again. If you start doing it in the minutiae, in the details of every syllable, it's not going to work. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there are a lot of voices of reformers that I think many of them kind of have different ideas. I mean, for example, somebody like Ayad Jamaluddin. I don't know if you're familiar with Ayad Jamaluddin. He's an Iraqi politician, and also he comes from a very religious family. He still wears the Imam, the Shia thing, and he also considers himself a reformer. His main argument is that, I mean, I think he has two main arguments, is that the first one is that the book should not, the book written in the 7th century should not dedicate the life in the 21st. And he also said that to protect the religion, we need to keep it away from the state. Because I think that one of the biggest enemies of Reformation is that religion and the state, a specific sect of religion mixed with the state, that doesn't allow any form of discussion to happen within these Muslim walls. So is that there's also Ahmed al-Qubanchi, and also another Iraqi Muslim reformer, who also considers that the book is too old for us to live. And also there is Majid Nawaz, and there is Asr Nomani. And so I'm mostly familiar with the reform movement in the Arab world than the one in the Western world. I think that if somebody like makes up this argument, like Ayad Jamaluddin, that the book is not applicable in the 21st century, at least the main, like the rules of jihad and the rules of martyrdom and stuff like this, we will find a much more benign version of Islam. Obviously, you're still going to have the superstition. I mean, for us as atheists, we consider all religions to be bullshit, including all the other ones, Hinduism and Judaism, all the rest. But if we're going to remove this, I think the most anti-civil society values, the values of jihad and martyrdom and anti-diversity, and if we can remove that by saying that these values belong to the 7th century, the same goes for child marriage, the same goes for female genital mutilation, all of that, we can have a much more, because if it's not applicable in the 7th century, then how are we going to live in the 21st century? So in the 21st century, they're going to follow liberal values. Obviously, they're going to call them Islamic. Right. But at the same time, there's a discussion I had with a gay imam in New York City. And I told him, you said he's a unicorn Muslim. I told him, how can you make sense? Like, you're a gay and you're a Muslim at the same time. And he said that Islam means to me life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Okay? That, I told him, you're quoting Jefferson. But if that's what makes you a better person, I don't think we need to focus a lot on logical consistencies. Religion itself is not based on logical consistencies.
The thing is, if you're going to remove those parts so that they become permanently removed from the religion, it can't be done without the doctrinal weight, without the tools that the Islamic jurisprudence would say, yes, it clears our criteria. Because, you know, this guy that you're talking about in Iraq can do all of the Macarena dance that he wants, but that's just one guy trying to find a way around these very problematic passages. So there has to be a systematic doctrinal way by which you could reinterpret these things permanently, so that it is permanently reformed. I don't care about the one guy who does all sorts of sidestepping, right? So, I mean, do you see any way by which there are specific reinterpretations of exact doctrines that can allow us to have this universal key to reinterpret all this stuff, or not really?
Well, I mean, I agree with you that, like, these, they don't have to, Christianity didn't have to get the full approval of all Christians for us to have, like, we still have the evangelicals who believe that they're 6,000 years old, and there's a woman I met from a group called Christians United for Israel, and I told her, like, why are you supporting Israel? I mean, you're a Christian. And she said, well, if the Jews kill more Arabs and the land of Israel is going to expand, then the Messiah is going to come back. Okay, so like, even within modern Christianity, sure, as we see it, there are still elements, like, there, at least in the United States, there's a significant amount of Christians who obviously are not as violent as jihadists, but it scares me that they would be in control of nuclear weapons, especially if somebody believes in Book of Revelations, right, and all of that. So, I mean, it doesn't need to, like, for Islam confirmation to happen, it doesn't need to get the full approval of the 1.5 billion Muslims. And I think that there are a lot of elements that can reduce the amount of people dependency on religion. I don't know if you have been to Turkey, for example. I mean,
when I was a kid.
Yeah, I mean, Turkey is that they obviously they had a secular state as a result of Ataturk. Now it's kind of getting backward, like regressive, with Erdogan. But
speaking of which, before you go on, I want to interrupt you. I want to read you something from Erdogan. You probably know this. The term moderate Islam is ugly and offensive. There is no moderate Islam. Islam is Islam. Do you know this quote?
Yeah, I think he's delusional in this. I think that these terms are being used. Let's be complete with Turkey, yeah, so sure. I can go with the moderate Islam thing. Is that, like, we go to Turkey, like, they go to bars and they drink, but when it's Azan time, they stop drinking. And then after that, and obviously this has no theological explanation whatsoever. I mean, drinking is not allowed in Islam at all. But people will always try to figure out a way to, because of the context of the regime of that country. And within the Middle East, I mean, these societies are very collective. So, like, if they get a one secular dictator, many people would immediately start being anti-Islamist. And yes. And so there is a lot of tribalism that, I mean, even if we ignore, like, I think that people just ignore religion. They don't need to fully comprehend the theological
right.
explanations for everything. I mean, most Muslims don't even know right. what the Quran is saying. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, they listen to what they see on television and whatever. But like, for the reform movement to happen, I think it happens, like, within some sophisticated circles or people who are, like, really interested in what the Quran is saying and stuff. But if you go to the, like, people on my age, the 22s and 24s and 26s, and, like, many of them have no freaking idea what, like, the Quran is saying. And so how can you create something that make them distracted away from religion?
Right.
And I think that that's also something that can be used to reduce radicalization and, because if you're going to make life much better and economically much much more sufficient and things of that sort, in which people are more free, there is going to be a decline in belief in religion to begin with. Just like what happened in countries in Scandinavia, in which the better they have a safer... I'm not trying to, like, say the same thing at the State Department, is that the reason people join jihadists is because there are no jobs. But I think that... If there are countries with good leadership and good sufficient economy, it will be able to distract people from the religion. Right. And I think that is, it's also much more, I see it much more plausible than people are playing war gymnastics
right.
with the articles of faith. I think that it's. I think I see, like, apostatization or people being non-religious,
right.
like not necessarily atheists, but just non-religious. I think it is much more. It's much easier. As for the jihadists, those people who, like, go and, like, take things very literalist, like the literalist, these are the biggest people to, I think, the counter. I think that is where the reformers movement can probably play a role and try to at least create doubts in their heads.
Right.
Which I think could be the biggest enemy of radicalization, is that if they engage with them for 3 hours about war gymnastics, there's probably... I mean, I think that they are much more able to convince these people than people like us who talk about right. evolution and neuroscience and Big Bang Theory. I think that if people speak the same language as they do, the reformers, I think, have a better chance. When it comes to a larger society, I think that non-religiousness and atheism has a better chance than reformers.
I think that, fair enough, there are two, I think, challenges in that region that are very earthly, non-religious. I think one of them, I touched on it with one of my former guests, maybe Peter Boghossian, which I'll repeat here. And the other one you actually mentioned, you were talking about tribalism. And so I wanted to actually read a quote to you and to the readers that actually perfectly captures the tribal mentality in the Middle East, which helps explain why oftentimes people, even though they may wish to criticize the in-group, refuse to do so because it is such a taboo to do so. And that that is not necessarily rooted in a religious ethos. It's actually a very earthly tribal thing. So I want to read something to you. This is from Leon Uris's book, The Hajj. And so let me read it exactly. So before I was 9, I had learned the basic canon of Arab life. It was me against my brother, me and my brother against our father, my family against my cousins and the clan against the tribe, and the tribe against the world, and all of us against the infidel. So you see how you keep coming up with gradations to create ever fine, you know, breakups of us versus them. And so I see it often with some of the otherwise very secular and liberal Muslim friends that I have, where, you know, they're all about reform, but then when you push them a bit, where they start getting that trigger of tribalism, they could turn inward and get very defensive.
I think that this is part of the, I mean, collective mentality is that the group is more important than the individual. And I mean, within the East, I mean, except probably Japan and South Korea, is that there's a huge culture of collectivism that goes back to culture and religion. And I mean, even if you take Muslims aside, I mean, you can see it in Assyrians. They also get very defensive about Christianity when they see somebody like me criticizing it. And the same thing with Jews is that they go so defensive about, like, if I say that there is racism in America, they don't see anything. If I say there's racism in Israel, they immediately all gang up on me as being some sort of anti-Semitic. So there is a lot of element, because I think that our, like, these societies, like the East, there's a very little concept of individualism that exists within these societies. And I mean, even now within civil wars, like, there are a lot of people who used to hate, in Iraq, Shia Iraqis, who used to hate Bashar al-Assad because Al-Qaeda used to be trained in Syria and being sent to Iraq.
Right.
And there are many Shias were killed by this. And now, because of the civil war, the Shias are siding with Assad, because he's against the Sunnis.
Right.
So, and you see, like, people who were very much against Saddam Hussein, who are Shia sectarian, but they also support Bashar al-Assad, who is the Ba'athist dictator, which is on the opposite side of Saddam Hussein. And the same thing goes for Sunnis, who are bashing Bashar al-Assad for being a dictator. And if you ask them, do you like Saddam Hussein? They say, we love him. So, like, why are you against Bashar al-Assad if you're pro Saddam Hussein? And you can see that the tribalism extended. I mean, now there is, like, I think it's like kind of intersectional, is that there's tribalism, there's religion, there's class, there's all these things mixed together that made up these societies that we're living now. And I would definitely put, like, tribalism as one of the top reasons.
So let me give you the other one. So as a psychologist, of course, I'm interested in the psychology of people. And so another one that I've identified, which, as I said, I spoke about it, I think, with Peter Boghossian, is the notion of the deep culture of honor and shame in the Middle East. And of course, as somebody from the Middle East, myself and you too, we really know what that means. Now, how do I apply that to the context of Islam? See, in the West, there is the reflex that you are a good person if you criticize yourself, like, right? If you have self-insight, right? If you go to see a therapist because you want to work on improving yourself, that is somebody who is, you know, highly attuned with themselves, right? If I criticize my government, I am somebody who's progressive, right? That's sort of one of the card-carrying, you know, behaviors of a progressive, is to constantly criticize their own government and so on. Well, these exact traits that are so laudable and wonderful in a Western context are disgusting and shameful in the Middle East, where you would never openly, never mind admit that you have a fault, but you would certainly never stand up to say, my society has a fault, my religion. Now, when I close the light and when I'm alone, I might admit it to myself, but I'm never going to admit it publicly. So until you get rid of this culture of honor and shame, you're never going to have a true self, you know, insight about these issues, right?
And those who do these things are called traitors and Zionists and mass murderers.
Jews.
Immediately. So obviously that has been a very big enemy of progress. I mean, I think one of them I posted that has went viral because, so after the Paris attacks, I was doing, because I still have a lot of friends like who live in Iraq and like who are Muslims and stuff. So the first thing, the first reflection after the Paris attack was how much this going to change, how gonna reflect on us.
Yes.
Like our image. Islam is going to turn bad. Islam is going to be criticized. Arabs are going to be criticized. And I was like, are you guys fucking crazy? Like, the first thing you think about after like 100 people, I think it was now 100, now 130 or something. Like, the first thing you think about is how much it's about you. Like, it's really everything about you and your culture. Like, there are people dead. How about first we condemn these attacks and then we discuss maybe there is something problem with us. Maybe that we are also part of the problem. And the... So they immediately turned everything about our honor, our image, our, and obviously that has been, I think, like self, and I think one of the biggest problems of religion and tribalism mixed together. I mean, was Saddam Hussein, because I grew up under Saddam Hussein, my childhood, and he's very intelligent because he mixed white Arab supremacy and Islamic supremacy together. So he was an Arab nationalist who believed that the Arabs had like the message of the prophet, and he also believed that Islam is the greatest religion. So he mixed these both. And when somebody believes in supremacy, they will always try to find somebody else at fault, not themselves.
Of course.
And because that's the problem with supremacy, is that when somebody believes that their book or their race is the most superior thing ever, they will think that everybody else is inferior to them. And when they think that everybody is inferior to them, they're not going to listen to anything these guys are saying. And they always try to shift the problem to somebody else. So, since the defeat of the Islamic Caliphate, the Ottoman Empire, the Arab world has been in a huge stage of victimization that they don't know what's going on. And they don't want to know what's going on. Is that it's they see that they're not united anymore. They're divided to a lot of countries. The British and the French occupied their land with all their sense of dignity and honor, and considering that Arabs used to conquer almost half the planet. And then the existence of Israel came in 1948, in which is a huge insult to the Arab world that was what Jerusalem used to be, one of the like Arab land, Jerusalem, one of the capitals of the Arab world. And they see that as a huge defeat and a huge, and since then, I mean, we could probably go roll back the history for more than 100 years, but since the defeat of the Ottoman Empire until today, the Arab world has been engaged in a huge sense of self-victimization that they think that everybody is the enemy. Everybody's trying to get something out of them. And when that happens, any attempts to actually change the societies are immediately viewed as form of treason or betrayal, or you're siding with the enemy and siding with the Jews and the Americans and the Mossad. Like, I still remember, like, I was 14 years old and I said I'm an atheist, okay? And then I was accused of being a Zionist.
Yes.
And I didn't even know what Zionism means back then. Like, I know that it's always talked about by Saddam on television, Sahyoni, and all of that, but I didn't know what Sahyoni actually meant. And I was accused of being a Zionist, and I was like, "What the fuck?" Like, I said, I don't really believe in God. Like, what has to do with anything? Like, what are you calling me? And then they were like, "Oh, you're working with the Jews, and you're working." And I was like, "Are you kidding me? Like, where's my paycheck?" Like, so now I'm 24, and it's been 10 years. It's been 10 years, and these fucking Jews never gave me anything.
Don't
and
worry, I was we're saving it for you in a bank. Don't worry.
Please, which one I want to know is that it's been 10 years and I've always been accused of some sort of a traitor, and it started with a purely simple thing. I mean, if you're gonna talk like with people like Majid Nawaz and trying actually, like and even not me myself now trying to change the whole thing. But even when I just said that I'm not part of your tribe, I get immediately accused of treason. And this is, I think, one of the biggest enemies of progress in this part of the world.
I think that's actually a very earthly solution to the problem. If you can get these societies to move from their current collectivist score, there's a famous psychologist called Hofstede, and he basically gave scores for different countries on a whole bunch of cultural traits. One of the most important ones in his metrics is how you score as a country or society on individualism versus collectivism, right? And as you correctly said, the Middle East scores off the charts in terms of its collectivism. If you could somehow find a way to move those societies so that they score higher on individualism, already that creates a more psychologically fertile ground for solving some of these problems. Because once people are able to start seeing themselves first as individuals, right? I mean, I care about what Faisal tells me in judging whether I like him, whether I respect him. I don't give a damn which clan or tribe he comes from. If you can get people to actually think in this classical liberal manner, I think it goes a long way towards solving some of these problems, yes?
Yeah, I mean, there are signs of, like, this thing exists more in cities around the Arab world. I mean, unfortunately, sorry, when it comes to elections, generally these cities feel like Baghdad. Like Baghdad, when I grew up, is that people come from different tribes and like the neighborhoods I grew up in, nobody cared about what this person is, a Sunni or a Shia or this tribe or whatever. But then you move 20 miles south, and then, like, now you literally cannot pass some of these areas without being part of the sects.
Yes.
So, and when the elections happened in Iraq, and when these people were allowed to vote, and the people in the south and the people who are tribal had more votes than the people who are not tribal, and eventually voted for tribal governments that created more war.
Of course.
So, but if you look at it, I think if we're gonna talk about solutions, I think one of the solutions is to create more metropolitan places and like create more cities create more jobs going to bring people from all over, and these people, because I think, I mean, Steven Pinker, I think, mentioned this, he said it's a political suicide to say it's I think academic suicide, a political suicide, if you mention that capitalism or free market can bring people together in academia. Like, if you say anything good about capitalism or anything good about free market, yes, economics, You are literally like surrendering to the devil. And like the socialists actually have a lot of tribal elements that, yes, I did not think that they have.
Oh yeah.
So if somebody, and I was like a very active, and I still hold some socialist beliefs, but if you just disagree with them, you are immediately labeled as a traitor. Like, this is exactly very similar to the
I'll give you a great example from my scientific life. There are several old Marxists, sort of, you know, the hippies of the 60s who are now in their 70s, who are evolutionists. They're evolutionary scientists, right? Evolutionary biologists. But because evolutionary psychology, right, so one of the branches of evolutionary theory, are viewed as in their idiotic minds, as an attack on their socialist beliefs, then they reject it. So they could both walk and say they are evolutionary biologists, but when it comes to applying evolutionary biology to the human brain, somehow it doesn't apply anymore because it is anti-Marxist. And I'll give you their names. I mean, the classic examples of these guys were very famous Harvard evolutionists, Richard Lewontin and Stephen Jay Gould, right?
Stephen Jay Gould, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
These are very serious scientists who have all the right pedigrees as evolutionary scientists, yet evolutionary psychology is somehow anti-Marxist. It is a right-wing conspiracy, and so therefore they hate it. So even people who are very educated can succumb to religious fervor, in this case, scientific fervor, but it's still a religion, right?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of people who have high degrees, I mean, Mr. Noam Chomsky.
He's my boy. I created the game 6 Degrees of Noam Chomsky. Are you familiar with the game?
I mean, no, but I think Jews all work together.
Hold on. Before you go on with Noam Chomsky, I need to receive props for my game. I created a game called 6 Degrees of Noam Chomsky. And the way the game works, it's based on the idea of 6 degrees of separation, right? That any two people can, right? 6 degrees of Noam Chomsky thinking works as follows. I tell you any calamity, an Amazon frog just died in the Amazon, and you have to, in 6 causal links or less, link it back to the U.S. industrial military complex. Very famous game online. What are you doing, man?
Yeah, I think I'm wasting my life.
Go on with Noam Chomsky. Yeah, go ahead.
I think Noam Chomsky is a highly intelligent human being. I think he's very well credentialed. I mean, he's not, many people forget, he's not credentialed in politics. He's credentialed in linguistics. I mean, his main field is linguistics. And I mean, MIT is a very respectable institution. And he's very well educated, but at the same time, he also subscribes to a very big dogma, which you, I think, you alluded to in terms of the that tried to links, or at least I'm starting the movements of linking. I mean, he started a movement that is now, you can see it in Democracy Now, you can see it in Cenk Uygur, you can see it in Glenn Greenwald, you can see it in all. I can see them all subscribing to a very similar. I think ideology that most of the things that are now what we call our problems are the main problem is the United States or the Western foreign policy. And so they try to link, I mean, everything within this warfare and also try to create moral equivalencies between the West and the people who attack the West. Yes. So they say that there has to be legitimate grievances that these people have to the way that they are doing these kinds of things. And they, I think it goes back, I mean, I'm not as well credentialed as you are, but I've read a lot about the critical race theory and the critical theory and the gender theory. And what I think my conclusion in all of that is that with the critical race theory is that they have little to talk about ideology whatsoever. Most of what they are talking about in the critical theory is mostly race, gender, class.
Yes.
I think the gender theory comes from it. And they try to link everything back to race, gender, class. And they put a huge, they ignore fully the role of ideology and culture and traditions within with the people that they're talking about. So they see that if somebody is from a lower class, they will say that this is his way of addressing his grievances against the upper class.
Yes.
So they always say things within oppression dynamics.
Yes.
Is that this the brown is oppressed by the white, the gay is oppressed by the straight.
Yes.
So if a black kills a white person, it's an expression of grievances against the white supremacy or any form of ruling of the white people of the United States or within the Western world. And they reflected that, which is a very domestic thing, into which obviously does not work even domestically. Yes. But I think Thomas Sowell, his famous book,
on the show, by the way.
Black Rednecks and White Liberals, I think that was his book, in which he talks about how these currency fails there, but they also try to apply that into a global affairs. And what happens is that they see that everything that is happening now with Iraq and Syria and all of this is a pure result of United States foreign policy.
Before you go on. So let me see if I understand what you're saying. So you mean the systematic gang rapes of the Yazidis is not an appropriate behavior in terms of your grievance against Palestine and Al-Quds, that those are not linked together?
I think they are linked. Just kidding. ideology defines our action and also defines our reaction to things. Is that many people within Iraq view the United States as an occupation. But there were people, the Christian Iraqis had a very different reaction to U.S. occupation. The Shia Iraqis had a very different reaction to Shia. So, like, if somebody is a U.S. Army, when he walks in a Yazidi neighborhood or a Christian neighborhood, he would face very different treatments than he would walk in Fallujah,
yes,
in Western Iraq, or Basra in Southern Iraq. And these ideologies matter. So when the United States invaded Iraq, if somebody look at it from a literalist Islamic point of view, they see it more of as like the Crusades. They see Christians invading Muslim land. And obviously there were machineries in the U.S. Army that obviously didn't help because there were people who came with the U.S. Army trying to convert Iraqis to Christians, and that didn't help. But even if these crazy machineries did not come with the United States, the United States is viewed immediately from a very negative angle. And so what happens is that when these so-called resistance movements started, and they start killing people from all over, Yazidis and Christians and whatever, the response from people like Noam Chomsky and others was that we created this.
Yes.
And even now it's being said, we created ISIS. And when this college girl went and confronted Jeb Bush, when she told him, your brother created ISIS, this is a reflection of this ideology that the United States is a pure reason why these countries happen. And I like, just think of how depressing the situation is. So they think that if we kept Saddam Hussein, there would be no ISIS. Okay, that may sound like a nice theory. What a depressing situation. If the only choices we have are Saddam Hussein and ISIS, what does it say about Iraq? If the only choices are Saddam Hussein and ISIS, and if we left, if somebody, just imagine this, somebody saying positive thing about Saddam Hussein, who was a genocidal fascist dictator, is actually viewed as a good option in countries in the Middle East. It says a lot about the Middle East than it says about the United States. And many people don't realize that. It's that they think that, oh, well, if the United States didn't intervene, Iraq would have been like now a prosperous liberal democracy. And so it's really, like, does it matter if somebody supports the Iraq war or does not support the Iraq war? Because if this is the only choices we have, it really speaks of a very much larger problem within the region. So this larger problem is being ignored by people because they only see the cause. They only see, okay, the United States had bases in Saudi Arabia and Arab Gulf, and that's what Osama bin Laden cited as the reason why he did 9/11. And they say, okay, well, if we're not there, then 9/11 would not have happened. So it's the same. So they apply the same dynamics.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, just to tell, as somebody who received a death threat from Al Qaeda, it really doesn't take hard work to piss them off. If somebody is really working hard not to piss off Al Qaeda to attack him,
right,
he's gonna live all his life in misery.
Right.
I can tell you that for a fact. I can say that as a person who tried actually to be living in hiding and tried to be an apologist, it really doesn't take much to piss Al Qaeda off. So the ideologies that has driven these terrorist groups needs to be fought, and they have been going on for years. And this concept that, other than this all self-victimizations of Noam Chomsky and his folks, it's time for them to actually think about what they have, people like them have done in the United States, and they should apply the same standards to people like that there, other than trying to apply different standards.
Well, and actually, you know, one of the things that I try to do, I mean, you know, all the stuff that I'm doing here now, let's say talking to you and so on, this is a side parallel career, if you'd like, to my scientific career, right? But it's because I really care about, you know, good ideas. I really care. I mean, you and I know what it is to live in the Middle East, and we are thankful. Tomorrow's Thanksgiving in the United States. We are thankful that there are places like the United States and Canada where we could escape and live free lives and have these interesting conversations. But I think, frankly, I have greater disdain for the Westerners that give coverage to those bad guys than the bad guys themselves. I mean, I have more respect for those bad guys than the Glenn Greenwald or whatever and Noam Chomsky and so on. And in a sense, if we could fight those guys so that there is no longer an intellectual climate that allows these morons to flourish, then I think already that goes a long way towards defeating the bad ideas. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think I mean what these people are held into the United States are like we're talking about the Islamic extremists,
Yes.
obviously here, is that the only people who are left to defend them are the liberals,
Right.
or I mean I'll call them liberals, the regressive left.
Yeah,
So in
exactly.
order to differentiate between, because for me, liberal means somebody on the center, center left,
You
center right.
meant the ostrich brigade.
The Ostrich Brigade. So the only people that are left to defend these. The Islamic extremists are either the apologists, like people like Linda Sarsour or Dean Obaidallah,
Yes,
or
yes, yes.
so there are this part, and but this part, like there are only 2% Muslims in the United States, and I think very small percentage of them are apologists. I mean, I know a lot of Muslim Americans who are very well educated and think that these guys are full of crap. But sorry, and then there's the left, the far left apologists to these apologists.
Yeah.
So. If the far left is going to be defeated because the apologists are relying on the far left for their defense, it's going to be literally nobody left to defend Islamic extremism in the West.
Right.
But the worrying factors, and there's I really want to like express my concern here, is that because of the failure of the left, like people of Glenn Greenwald and stuff, there's a huge rise of the far rights in the United
Yes.
States, and that make would make they consider both of us as the enemy.
Yes.
It's like if me and you walk in a place in which it's filled with people with Confederacy flags, I think we're gonna probably consider with their guns and their Bibles and all of
Yes,
that.
yes.
I can tell you that probably they will kill both of us.
Yes.
And I'm much more afraid. So, but at the same time, I see that as a secondary, as a result of the failure of the far left, because many people are afraid. Like the far left are telling them there is nothing wrong with Islam, everything is good, and if we don't intervene, everything is fine. But France never intervened except in Libya, and that's all. And then they get attacked in France, in Paris, like of all places, in the capital of France, and people like there's this party, Le Pen, I think it's called the Le Pen,
Yeah,
the Marine Le Pen.
Le Pen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also rising up
Yeah.
now after the Paris attacks, and these people who consider that we should kick out all the immigrants and we should stop close the borders and like it's so the like that's why I think like fighting the far left would really prevent at least here in the United States and Canada. I mean, we do have our rednecks. I think United States we have much more than Canada, but we do have our crazies. But at the same time, we can reduce their rising if we're able to defeat the far left here, because I think they are creating the far right. I'm not being the Noam Chomsky here by saying creating a causal
Yeah,
link, but I think that there is a huge fear within the American public that if there is another attack is going to happen in New York or in DC or in Boston, all these places, it's going to lead to a huge rise of the Republicans, and not only the Republicans. The far right Republicans, like now in the Republican Party, George W. Bush would be considered a Democrat.
Right.
Like Ronald Reagan would probably be considered a Democrat, even though they're all praising him as some sort of a Republican hero. But like the Ted Cruz and the Sarah Palin and the Mike Huckabee, these guys make Ronald Reagan look like a Democrat.
Right.
And leave aside the Christian fascism that they want to bring to the United States of trying to like all what they focused on is gays and abortion, like all what
Right.
they talk about. So it's very worrisome that I don't know if you have listened to the Sam Harris latest discussion with Douglas Murray, and now he's like all
No.
over the, so he did mention that because of the crazy situation right now, he would consider voting for a religious imbecile. He called it the religious imbecile, Ben Carson, over Noam Chomsky. So he's now very it's not so so the Glenn Greenwalds, what they're doing, they're attacking him as endorsing Ben Carson. So talk about being disingenuous. But the more these people are gonna do these kinds of stuff, the more there's gonna be, I think that there's gonna be a counter movement that are much less intellectual and much more damaging. Like the people who believe, like the Pamela Giller, like the,
Yes.
If you look at Pamela Giller, for example, I look at her Facebook page and I'm like looking in wonder, like what kind of a brain she has? Like all like whenever something happens in America, it's like Muslim
Yeah.
jihadists,
and Obama trying to impose Sharia law in the country, like literally. And like, and she kept like saying about Obama born in Kenya and we should not. She's like a quote unquote birther, but there's a reason why people like Pamela Geller became more popular after 9/11. It's because of the failure of the left and the failure of the apologist Muslim that kept telling people that it's all our fault and nothing to do with Islam. There's just sin kumbaya, and attacks keep happening in the West, and the response has always been the same. It's nothing to do with Islam. It's all about America.
I think what's happening now, I mean, maybe as we kind of wind down the chat, let's sort of end it on an optimistic note. I think what I'm seeing in sort of my contribution to this debate, and I think you probably will agree, by us speaking in a very reasoned, dispassionate, you know, proper manner, it's granting people the green light, the courage to actually also voice their input. So I get a lot of emails. I mean, tons,
so do I.
Right?
So do I, yeah.
Just
yeah.
Somebody saying, you know what, just hearing you speak about this, given your background, given how you speak, given obviously you're not an extremist, given obviously you're a very liberal person, it gives them a compass that says it's okay for them to have felt the things that they're feeling. And then they go off and start having these discussions. And then often they'll report back to me and say, hey, guess what? I just changed the mind of a member of the Ostrich Brigade. And so I think that's what I call sort of trench warfare, you know, street to street, right? Salon to salon, cafe to cafe, right? By everybody getting engaged in the discourse, not being afraid of the political correctness, the thought police. I think that's hopefully what you got, you, me, Dave Rubin, Sam Harris, all these guys are contributing, is giving the courage for people, never mind to speak publicly. Maybe you and I speak publicly. They don't have to speak publicly, but at least have the courage to challenge people in the classroom, right?
Yeah. I mean, since I started, like, I give talks around the United States, and I have like a lot, because I engage a lot with the students. Like, I right. don't like just give a speech, and like generally, like I give a speech for 1 hour, and like, Q&A goes for 2 hours, and I'm also like bring like a big bottle of water with me just in case I would need, and because the far left try to guilt them. They tell them if you have any doubts about like the talk about Islamic reform and stuff. You are a racist. You are a bigot.
Yes.
And they try to guilt them. So just like the guilt of religion is that, oh, if you're gonna have sex, you're gonna go to hell. So they try to guilt them. Like, no, you are applying microaggression or racism or inner racism, inner bigotry, and check your privilege. And they tell them all these things that makes them very afraid of even talking. Like, I think our dear friend Al Rizvi said Islamophobia. He went at this term. It's like, is that there's a fear of being perceived. Because now the term racist, I mean, the term racist is a very big one. And like now being used 24/7, and it can destroy careers. But also back to the positive note, like within my project, which is movements.org, and what we try to do is that we try to crowdsource the human rights. So we try to connect activists, liberals, and secularists in the Arab world, and also other societies like North Korea and China and everywhere, activists and political dissidents with people in the West who have the skills to help them. So let's say I'm a woman rights activist in Afghanistan and want to get published. We have a partnership with the New York Times, Women in the World. We create a match.com of skills of a woman who wants media coverage and somebody who can help them. And I've seen a lot of liberals, our people, who are dedicated to help activists over there. They're sick and tired of the apology that it's not, we can never do anything, or it's all our fault, and we have to kick Obama, impeach Obama to create a safer government. There are a lot of liberals like who go and say, you know what, women rights in America, we support women rights in America, and we support women rights in Saudi Arabia, we support women rights in Afghanistan, we support women rights in Iraq, and human rights are human rights. And I can see a lot of signs of hope, but at the same time, we should not just like let the aggressives have open, because I think that, especially now with the age of social networking, I mean, as somebody, like, just like I was able to get 300,000 followers Al-Qaeda can get 300,000 followers. Like, the age of social media, like, voices can be amplified kind of very easily. Like, you don't need to buy a sophisticated machine to be able to access Facebook. Like, iPhone costs $200, and somebody can use an iPhone and all these Vine and all these apps that somebody can record. And so is that we are, like, literally at a continuous battle, because it's very easy for a crazy guy to do a lot of damage. And I speak as somebody from Iraq, like, it didn't really take a lot of guys to control a neighborhood. Like, many people think that you need the 10,000 people. Right. But if you get, like, 200 who are very well trained, and they know how to use their Kalashnikov, and they know how to use their RPG-7, they're able to control the neighborhood. Like, right. Now, with the technology we have, you don't need to have a critical mass to do something. You just need a smaller group of dedicated people, and they can change everything. And I think that us, like me, you, Ali, Sam, Dave Rubin, if we're all dedicated, even if we are small, I think we can change a lot.
That's a wonderful way. So are there any upcoming projects that you haven't yet announced that you'd like to take this opportunity to announce beyond your movement.org, beyond your fantastic Facebook page that you're working on that you'd be willing to share, or nothing else?
Well, I mean, there is a campaign we are starting within movements of a campaign against ISIS, and our motto is that let's make the change from within, and let's help activists in Iraq and Syria to create the change from within. So that's actually so movements is the main project. We have multiple projects within movements that deals with different countries and different issues. So our next campaign is going to be against ISIS, and wow. We're gonna have a French website also. So if there's any French,
well, I speak French.
Je ne parle français très bien. Je parle anglais. Français.
Okay. Is there a way that we can maybe clone you and create 1 million versions of you and parachute you down to the Middle East to help? Is there a way? Could we clone you?
I think inshallah.
Inshallah.
So somebody's gonna invent something.
Very nice. Hey, Faisal, we could go on for another 3 hours. This was fantastic. I'll put it up. Hopefully by tomorrow, I'll tweet you when it's ready. I'll put up.
Inshallah.
Shukran, habibi. Charafna, and I'll talk to you soon. Huh? Stay on the line. I'm just gonna stop it, but stay on the line. Ciao.
Okay.